What's the next size smaller than a mallard?
I don't know.
That like what are the ones you see out?
October 18th, 1978. Speaking to Chuck Dart, Manly Hot Springs.
12-wheel, 8-wheel.
You want to try that back?
Yeah, you know why? It sounds real to me. But the only reason it doesn't sound real is because when you speak, you hear it from the inside.
Yeah, right. I know. That's why I don't like the sound, bitch. Have you got the thing on?
Okay. Well, I'd like to go over some questions, clarifying even more what we talked about last time, and then we'll talk about times you got in trouble and stuff when you ran away from home. Well, I was wondering, you mentioned a little bit about the depression, and I was wondering what that was like where you were living. How was your family affected by it?
Well, there was very little work for the railroad men. Only the men with the greatest seniority worked, and they didn't work very much because the steel mills weren't producing that much steel, and they weren't hauling much ore. So it was, and it's a summertime thing anyway, very seasonal. Just when the Great Lakes are open for transportation. Excuse me, but as far as me being aware of there being a depression, or being in a state of poverty, I was not aware of this. Everybody was in the same boat. It wasn't that we were unique, and little kids pretty much adapt to the situation that they find themselves anyway. They don't know any better. They have no other standard of comparison. Their form of life is the only thing they know. So it's no big thing, but we didn't go without food, or I'm sure that it was probably a more or less a continuing source of concern for my parents because of the very small income, and I'm sure that this was a concern for virtually everybody there.
You talked a lot about your parents last time, and I was wondering if there are any kind of phrases that stand out, things that they would say to you, you know, whether it be advice or something that tore you here.
There undoubtedly were things, but right at the moment, I can't recall anything specific.
Mm-hmm. I mean, if there might be some kinds of things that, well, values that they taught you that were important to them. Anything to remember?
Well, I was a skinny little kid, pretty puny, not at all robust, and I was forever being urged to eat. I can remember my grandmother saying, "Eat, kid, it's the belly that holds up the back." And I do recall one thing that we did hear over and over again was that about if you get in trouble in school, you're going to be in more trouble when you get home.
Did that ever happen?
We never brought the school trouble to home for that very reason.
What kind of trouble were they talking about? You know, like fights and stuff?
Any kind of disruption, because my mother had been a school teacher, and she was sympathetic to the school situation. And she knew that kids could be rambunctious and sometimes get out of hand. Yeah. So if we got a licking at school, we'd have a second one when we got home.
You mentioned the first time you went to a movie, and it was about Africa, it took place in Africa. And you've wanted to go ever since. Well, when was the first time you ever heard about Alaska?
Oh, I must have been a pretty small kid. My father had a cousin that lived in Wrangell years ago, before World War I. And in the family photo album at home, there are pictures of totem poles and stuff that I can recall seeing among my earliest memories. And my father worked in Northern British Columbia before World War I on a railroad called the Edmonton, Dunvegan, and British Columbia. And he liked it very much. He liked that part of the world, and his plan was to come to Alaska when he retired from the railroad and live in Alaska. So I was pretty well primed about Alaska, so that when the Alaska Highway was being built and there was a small company in Duluth that got a contract for land clearing, I had a chance to go to work with them. I was not yet subject to the draft, and that's how I came north. And I landed in Dawson Creek, BC in June of 1942, and then worked out of Fort St. John, north of Fort St. John and close to Fort Nelson for about 9 months, and then went back to Minnesota, and then came back to Whitehorse and worked in a refinery for, it was Bechtel Price Callahan at that time.
What was your job?
First, I was a flunky in the kitchen, and then I was a grease monkey in the alkylation section of the refinery, which meant that I was taking care of some valves in a section of the refinery that was using a totally new process, or at least they were using a catalyst that they had never used before, hydrofluoric acid, which is an extremely active acid, and they had a lot of precautions in there. We wore special overalls of balloon cloth and neoprene boots and gloves, and had helmets with face masks, plastic face masks. And we, because the very corrosive nature of the hydrogen fluoride or hydrofluoric acid, the lubricant that was used in the valves was very special, and they had to be steamed, the valves. We had to grease them every 8 hours, and they had to be steamed in order to get the grease, or the lubricant, I shouldn't say grease. I don't know what it was, but it was foul-smelling stuff, too. But anyway, to be able to pump the grease into the valve, we had to put live steam on the valve and then pump it in. Our grease guns were kept in the steam cabinet also. And that hydrogen or hydrofluoric acid is one of the most active chemicals there is. It's the material that dissolves glass, and it will dissolve concrete. It's very active if there's water involved too. So they went to great lengths to keep water out of it as much as possible.
What was it dissolving?
Oh, what was it used for? Mm-hmm. It was used as a catalyst to produce high octane gasoline in the refining process. There was one incident that was I'm not too proud of. There was a safety engineer that was on duty. There was one for every shift. We worked three shifts. And he had seen me sliding down a steel ladder from a deck, an elevated deck. Because of the suits and the rubber gloves and rubber boots we wore, it was pretty easy just to clamp your legs and hands on the outside of the steel ladder, and by varying the pressure that you applied to the ladder, you could control your descent. And anyway, the safety engineer saw me doing that and really chewed me out. And not long after that, there was need to remove a pump. Incidentally, everything in that section was a dual system, one air and one electrical. So if there was a failure of one, the other could go into operation. And they had emergency showers around there, or if there was any exposure to this fluid, you could run in and just stepping on a treadle and it release a whole bunch of water to wash the stuff away. There was one case of a chamber or a tank being opened for cleaning. They had flushed it out as much as they could and vented it, and then removed the manhole, and there was a workman inside with a waterproof outfit. He dropped a nut and he reached into the sludge. He took off his glove and reached into the sludge and picked up that nut, and which was a big mistake. Before they could stop the action of the hydrogen fluoride, it penetrated the flesh and dissolved the bones in his fingers to pencil point fineness. But anyway, that gives an indication of the type of material. And as I was saying, there was this dual system. They were replacing a pump. And because of the steam that they were using, and they had a dual system of valves too. So if there was a failure of one valve, the other valve could be operated to close off the system. Anyway, the one pump was removed, and one of the two valves, the one closest to the pump, was open. The one behind was closed, and the safety engineer wanted to close that one that was open, and they were steaming the valve, and the pump right next to this was what they call a grasshopper pump, so named because of it was a piston pump, and it had a two component arm that worked something like your own arm from the shoulder. And I saw him in that steam. There were several of us standing around the whole operation. Incidentally, the safety engineer was the only man that had a self-contained air supply to his helmet. The rest of us had helmets, but we were breathing air that was in the room, whereas he had air coming through a line. But he reached for the valve to shut it off, but he grabbed the handle on the one that was shut off, and I should have yelled at him. I noticed that he was getting the wrong valve, but because he had chewed me out the day before, I just let him open the wrong one, and it shot a 3-inch stream of this fluid, which is a mixture of petroleum and the acid, under 90 pounds pressure. And of course it shot it across the room, and as soon as he just opened it and he realized it was wrong, and he shut it off again. But then we all ran for the exits to get the hell out of there. But he went to go too, but his air hose got caught in that grasshopper pump. And I stood at the doorway and looked back at him, and the electrical switch controlling the pump was on a pedestal near the pump. And he was just able to reach that pedestal switch, and then the pump would draw him back, and he would reach out and just barely grasp at the switch and pull him back. It was like a horror movie. You know? And after I don't know how many tries, he finally was able to flip the switch and shut off that grasshopper pump and get himself released and get out of there. But that was a disgraceful thing on my part not to stop him, because he could have been, he could have lost his life in this situation. Not too proud of that. I don't know why I told you.
Seems like everybody could have, though.
That's true. But I don't know if the others noticed it in the steam, but I did. I did see that he was, I knew he was going to open the wrong one.
Did you know what was going to happen?
Mm-hmm. A new facet of me, you see.
Did you edge closer to the door when you saw it?
No, I was ready to run. You can't, right?
How old were you then?
Let's see, that had be, I was 23.
You quit working there after that?
No. That was pretty close to the end of the, whole operation. I'm sure that we never produced enough high-octane gasoline to fuel the aircraft that supplied us with parts and material for that refinery.
Where did the
material come from? Oh, different parts of the United States. But it was, and we never did, this was supposed to have been a high priority thing. It's why they used that place as a kind of a experimental place for this new process. I don't know. Because of the high risk involved, and also because of the duplication in the that alkylation section must have been very expensive to put up. It seemed to me they would have been better off doing it in a place in Chicago or someplace, you know.
Did any of the raw materials come from there?
No, oh, the refining chemicals, I don't know where they came from. The hydrofluoric acid came in steel cylinders, heavy steel cylinders. The petroleum came from Norman Wells on the Mackenzie River. There was the canola pipeline that went from the Mackenzie River to Whitehorse. But we never did get into full operation until after the shutdown order came through, and we were running what they called slop alky through, which was stuff that didn't come to specifications the first time, but running it through the second time, it was a breeze.
So when you were there, what would you do when you weren't working?
Oh, we skied a little, and there was an old copper mine outside of Whitehorse, went there a few times, fooled around, and there was a lake that I don't remember the name of outside of Whitehorse, a rather large, deep lake, and we fished for lake trout there, and fooled around on the Yukon River, went to Miles Canyon and the Whitehorse Rapids. There's the narrow gauge railroad there, the White Pass in Yukon. I was in Whitehorse for about 18 months. And after the shutdown order came, of course, this was during the war, and we were all subject to the War Manpower Act. So you couldn't change jobs without permission. And they had representatives from the oil companies there. And as I recall, I had an opportunity to go either to Arabia or the Aleutian Islands. And my roommate chose Arabia and I chose the Aleutian Islands. So I wound up out on Amchitka. And that's where I was when the war ended. And I wanted to go to college, and I wanted to stay in Alaska. And of course, the only choice was the University of Alaska. So I ended up in Fairbanks. The trip from Amchitka to Anchorage was something. I took a little freight service boat from Amchitka to Adak, and then we were stuck in Adak for a couple of weeks waiting for another freight service boat, which we got, and went from there to Whittier. But just out of Adak, we ran into a storm on the Bering Sea, which was pretty interesting for me. It was just like in the movies with the wind making the ropes sing and the rigging and the waves breaking over the bow and sweeping across the deck and pitching around or up and down on the waves. Quite a few got seasick, as I recall. There were very few that didn't get seasick, even of the crew. And when we landed at Dutch Harbor, there was an ambulance to meet the ship, and they took off four guys that had been throwing up blood, opening up ulcers, I guess.
What was it like in Antarctica?
It's a beautiful island in that the sedges and grasses are very green. I didn't check the full length of the island, just the one end where the military installations were. Of course, it's all volcanic. There were sea otters there at the time. We were told that that was the location of the largest colony of sea otters, and they were interesting to watch. And there were also blue foxes along the beach that were not afraid of people. They seemed to be quite curious and would come quite close to you. If you're walking along the beach, they would walk along behind you, maybe 40 or 50 feet. And there were quite a few waterfowl. And as I recall, there were some eagles, but my memory may be tricking me on that, but I'm pretty sure there were. It just doesn't seem like they should be there, but I think they were. Some of the formations of lava were interesting. What they call pillow lava is lava that's extruded beneath the sea. And then with the uprising of the land, it's exposed. And there was some of that in one of the pits on Adak. That was interesting to see.
Did you do any hunting or anything like that while you were there?
No, there was nothing to hunt. And I don't recall specifically, but I doubt if we would have been permitted to hunt anyway. I know there was some, a little illegal trapping of foxes.
What was your job?
I worked in I was classified as a warehouseman, and for a while I worked in heavy equipment spare parts. And then I was transferred to a lumber yard and was a warehouseman there, which meant I issued lumber to those companies that were to receive it, those units that were to receive it. But by the time I got there, there wasn't much of that going on, just very minimal stuff. There were times that, much of the time, I wasn't doing anything productive.
How did you compare Alaska with where you'd grown up?
Oh, gee, it was great. Before I came to Alaska, I was working in Madison, Wisconsin. And I was working in a dime store there as a stock boy at 30 cents an hour. And out of that 30 cents, I was paying my own room and board. I stayed at a rooming house, and I ate my meals in restaurants. And for an 8-hour day, that only comes to $3.20, right?
30 cents an hour?
Yeah.
Yeah, $2.40.
Huh? Oh, $2.40. Yeah.
Unless you get overtime.
Right, which I didn't get. I didn't get overtime. And then I moved up to Montgomery Wards and was making 50 cents an hour.
Jesus Christ, that's
yeah.
That's up to $4 already.
Yeah. So it was. It was in marked contrast to that Alaska looked real good to me. When I came north, I signed a contract for $35 a week plus my room and board, but there was no stipulation about the hours, and they could work me as many hours as they saw fit, which was the case.
Did How many hours did that usually turn out to be?
Well, when I first arrived, I don't recall whether we started at 5 o'clock or 4:30 in the morning to have breakfast ready for the crew. Like I say, I was a flunky in the kitchen, and I did the usual things. It was like a lumber camp, doing dishes, setting the table, and waiting on table a little. And we had to scrub the floor every day with scrub brushes on sticks with hot water. And then we'd have a break between breakfast and lunch, and between lunch and dinner, and then we'd be through with the last of it about 8 o'clock in the evening. And because, well, there were most of us young kids working in the mess hall, we had a lot of energy, and we'd fool around and go down to the Peace River and maybe swim in a backwater. That was my first experience with the long sunny days and very short nights, and didn't have sense enough to go to bed. So I was perpetually short of sleep for quite a while. But I really loved the work and being there. I shouldn't say I loved the work. It was in big contrast to what I had done, and the atmosphere was what made it interesting for me. Everything to hear the stories that drifted around in the barracks when those guys were from all over and had stories, and I was dumb and green, and everything was interesting. Now I'd find it a nuisance.
The stories are just...
Yeah, and all the noise, and not being able to sleep, and the drunkenness and whatnot. At that time, the drunks were pretty well under control. It didn't happen too often, but it was an open barracks, and you were just, I don't know, 2 or 3 feet away from bunks on each side of you, and so guys stumbling around in the middle of the night or sitting on the end of the bunk talking with a friend, and
were there people from Alaska who had grown up in Alaska working there?
I don't think so. They were from mostly from the upper Midwest, and of course this was not Alaska, this was British Columbia. And I would guess that most of the Alaskans were working in Alaska.
What year was that?
42 and into 43. And from then, as I said, I went to Whitehorse in the Yukon, and from there to Amchitka. I did land in Fairbanks on the way to the Aleutians, but that's all. Just landed out at Ladd Field, and then down to Anchorage. We stayed in Anchorage for a while, waiting for good weather. Or an airplane, I don't know what we were waiting for anyway. And I don't recall just how long it was we were in Anchorage, maybe 6 or 7 days.
There was a base on Antarctica then?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, there was an active military base there, Air Force, or Army Air Force. They didn't have an Air Force. Was it Army? Navy. I guess Christ, I don't know what it was.
Something like that.
Yeah, they had Navy and Army, I guess. There were two airstrips. One of them was on a real slope, which was strange to me. But I guess those fighter planes could take off in a hurry going downhill.
How many people were there?
I have no idea.
Civilians besides you?
Yeah, there were quite a few civilians. You know, the civilians were the ones that built the airstrips and stuff like that.
Were the civilians people from outside?
Or? Yeah, they were mostly from outside. There were a few from Alaska there. There's one guy I remember from Halibut Cove.
Did you ever meet any of the Aleuts?
No. They had been removed from the islands prior to my arrival.
Where'd they go?
No, I'm not too sure if they were brought to Washington, that is the state of Washington, or if some stayed in Alaska, but they were removed from the Aleutian Islands.
Why? For their own protection?
Mm-hmm. At the time of the Japanese did capture some, you know. And Kiska was within sight of Amchitka. On a clear day, you could see Kiska.
What does that mean, Kiska?
Well, Kiska was one of the islands that the Japanese occupied. It was... It was evacuated, though, under cover of fog. And when the American forces landed on Kiska, there weren't Japanese there, unlike Attu. The American forces leapfrogged Kiska, and there was the Battle of Attu. And then after the Japanese forces were defeated on Attu, they attacked Kiska, but the Japanese had slipped away. And I really don't know how many of the Aleutian Islands were populated at the time of World War II and just which ones the people were evacuated from. But to the best of my knowledge, there were no Aleuts on Amchitka when I was there. And nor did I see any of their homes.
When did you first have any contact with Native people or people who had been raised in Alaska?
Probably at the university. Thanks. No, there were a couple of natives from Southeastern that were working at Amchitka. Yeah, some Tlingits.
Did you spend any time with them?
Not a heck of a lot. There was, I don't remember the guy's name. He was a young fellow. And I remember that he borrowed money from me. And later, he saw me in Fairbanks and paid me. And I was really impressed because that didn't always happen with white guys that I'd lent money to.
Well, when did you decide or realize that you're going to stay in Alaska?
Probably about 3 weeks after I came north. Maybe not that long.
Mm-hmm. Was it a conscious decision? I'm never going back home.
No, it was just a great experience for me. I really enjoyed being there. And the work situation at home was so bad for me that by contrast, it was just like heaven being up here. Incidentally, that $35 a week, I couldn't work hard enough to earn that kind of big money. And then my wages were raised to $50 a week before the week was out. And that was, it was just absolutely hopeless to earn that kind of money.
And then your room and board is
right. To that? Right. No, that was, we got room and board also. Of course, the room wasn't great, but the grub was very good. By depression standards, it was really great. I can remember eating all the pineapple I wanted.
Yeah, pineapple.
What did you do with that? I hung on to it.
Did you have any idea what you're going to do with it?
Well, excuse me. My goal was to have enough money to buy a farm in Wisconsin, but that really didn't. That was what I started out with, but after a while, I was just accumulating money, and I had about $5,000 by the time I started school at the university, which was 3 years later.
I'm really curious on construction projects in the north, you know, like people that are working in the pipeline and everything, that said that most of the workers there really didn't know anything about the country that they were in. Stuff like some guy would say that they were from, say, some town like Tanana, and people would go, "Where's Tanana, you know, or what's that?" And not really know anything about the country that they were involved in. Did you find a similar kind of situation?
I don't recall that specifically, but I wouldn't be surprised if that's true. I may have been more curious than the average guy in this regard and more interested in the country. I can remember ordering books on Alaska and the Yukon Territory when I was there. And when I was in White Horse, I went to visit the editor of the White Horse Star and talk with him. I started a course in White Horse on geology in the north. But I don't know how many people were interested in that way.
What kind of conversations did you have with the editor of the White Horse?
I did. The only thing I can remember was him showing us that he was a member of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, which impressed me. His name was Moore. I've forgotten what his first name was.
Well, after you left Antifa and had your short stop in Anchorage, where did you head to?
to Fairbanks and the university. I was already late to enroll at the university, and took the train from Anchorage to Fairbanks. And at that time, it was a two-day trip. The train stopped at Curry, and you overnighted there in the railroad hotel, and then went on to Fairbanks the next day. And the coaches had the wood-burning heaters in each end to keep the place warm.
Did they manage to do it?
Yeah, of course, this was September, so it was no big deal. Oh. Good. My-